They include examples like the pesticide DDT and PCBs. Alarm bells rang for scientists when they noticed that POP levels at a Norwegian research station were increasing in the mid-2000s, because the chemicals are banned under the Stockholm Convention and haven't been produced for decades. The researchers conclude that the cause isn't new chemicals, but old ones being released from the Arctic ice as it melts in response to climate warming. The study suggests that the pollutant release will intensify in the future as impacts of climate change become more severe. Another major concern is that these chemicals may reduce the effectiveness of the Stockholm Convention, the international treaty that had been credited with helping reduce global POP levels.
A research paper published in the scientific journal Nature provides evidence that Atlantic cod and other large predatory fish populations on the Scotia Bank east of Nova Scotia may be showing signs of recovering from their population collapse in the early 1990s. The research, led by Kenneth T. Frank of the Bedford Institute of Oceanography in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, suggests that major changes to marine ecosystems can be reversed with time. According to Frank's paper, since around 2005, there have been signs that the cod and other large predatory fish populations on the Scotia Bank are recovering. The study describes the stages that have led to this point. Following the collapse of cod and other predatory fish, prey species such as plankton-feeding herring and capelin increased greatly in numbers, reaching populations 9 times their levels prior to the collapse. At these levels, they competed with the early life stages of the large predatory fish, preying on their eggs and young, and thereby hampering the species' recovery. But following peaks in 1995 and 1999, the plankton-feeding fish population crashed, having overeaten its food resources. This crash provided a window of opportunity for the cod and other predatory fish to begin increasing their numbers. The study indicated that there is an internal damping capacity of the ecosystem, and it is not solely management strategies that probably initiated the return to the former ecosystem structure. Several factors could alter ongoing recovery, including the current dominance of haddock over cod. Recovery in other ecosystems, such as the Black Sea and the Sea of Japan, have been delayed by jellyfish blooms, the presence of invasive species, and by eutrophication, all of which are possible off Canada's east coast. Global climate change could have a positive or negative effect, wrote the authors of the paper. Despite our worst fears, recent research gives us hope that the east coast marine ecosystems and its iconic species, the North Atlantic cod, may yet recover.
Thousands of fish turned up dead in 3 Prince Edward Island rivers following heavy rainfall events the preceding weekend. The cause of the fish kills has yet to be confirmed, but the lead culprit is poisoning from pesticides from nearby farmers' fields that were washed into the rivers by rain. Legislation in the province calls for a 15-meter buffer zone between the river and the field, but critics are saying this legislation isn't enforced and that 15 meters is not enough to prevent injury to fish. The fish deaths are record-setting, as the levels of fish mortality exceeds any PEI fish kill since 1972, when chemicals were dumped directly into the West River. Residents are also concerned that exposure to the pesticides could have consequences for human health. The province plans to introduce trout to the affected rivers to jumpstart their fish populations, but it will take years for the stocks to recover.
The federal government will not be committing new funding to the Eco-Energy for Renewable Power program. This announcement was made on July 28th by Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver. Minister Oliver said that one reason for the cut to funding was spending restraint due to a need for the Canadian government to cut $4 billion in spending annually to help it balance its budget by the fiscal year starting April 2014. The program encourages the generation of electricity from renewable energy sources such as wind, low-impact hydro, biomass, photovoltaic, and geothermal energy. The cut comes in spite of praise for the program by groups such as the Clean Air Renewable Energy Coalition, which called for the expansion and extension of the Eco-Energy program. Groups such as the Canadian Wind Energy Association have also called on the government to renew the program. Liberal Energy and Natural Resources critic David McGuinty was critical of the Conservative government's decision to cut funding, citing the program as the latest casualty in the Conservative government's battle to eliminate its self-created budget deficit. Cutting this program, McGuinty says, will harm Canada's ability to act on climate change. Based on the latest announcements, no new contribution agreements will be signed, although many projects with agreements made before March 31, 2011 will continue to receive payments up to March 31, 2021.
That wraps it up for this week's Rapid Fire News Attack.
Terra Informa is heard across Canada in over 60 communities. For more information about anything you've heard on today's show, visit Terra Informa's website at www.terrainforma.ca or send an email to us at terra@cjsr.com. Michael Carolyn is a sociologist who has some interesting things to say about how our food is made. Food certainly looks cheap at the supermarket, and middle-class North Americans pay far less for food, relative to their incomes, than they did only a generation ago. But Michael Carolyn argues that this cheapness is a product of bad agricultural policies that are pushing the costs onto the environment, onto other countries, and onto future generations. Michael Carolyn is based at Colorado State University, and later in the year his new book will be making its public debut. It's called The Real Cost of Cheap Food. Here he joins Terra Informa correspondent David Cochin to explain its arguments. This piece first aired in February.
Dr. Michael Carolyn, thank you very much for joining Terra Informa.
Thanks for having me.
So later on in the year, you have a new book coming out, and that book is called The Real Cost of Cheap Food. What do you mean by that title?
It's just kind of turning the concept of cheap food on its head. You'll often hear people talk about how and tout how we produce the cheapest food, and we, meaning developed countries in the West largely, produce some of the cheapest food in the world. Now, point to statistics such as how we're spending less of our annual incomes today on food than in any previous generation. And I basically try to point out that, in fact, when you take into consideration all of the costs that have been what economists would say externalized, or what I would say have been socialized, socialized meaning we're still paying for them, but now it's taxpayers, it's future generations, it's the environment. When you take all of these costs into consideration, our cheap food is actually incredibly expensive.
So can you give us some tangible examples? Where are we paying for food indirectly through this subsidization or socialization of food costs?
Well, what's often talked about is the externalization of costs onto the environment, but I also try to fold in many other examples of cost. One of the big ones that I can easily point to, because there's lots of data on the subject, is the cost to healthcare. If you're able to link food policy to the rising overweight and obesity epidemic, which I think the evidence is pretty substantial, when you're able to point to how farm subsidies incentivize the consumption of fatty, salty, sugary foods and kind of provide a disincentive for the consumption of fruits and vegetables, if you're able to link up food policy to the overweight and obesity epidemic, you realize that there's all of these costs that's being borne by the healthcare industry that arguably are the result of our own food policies. And just taking those costs into consideration, which estimates place direct and indirect costs per country in the hundreds of billions of dollars per year, that alone should open people's eyes to realize that our cheap food isn't so cheap.
So we're paying only a few dollars for a burger, but we're paying thousands in medical bills. I've heard it said that we don't actually have food policies in America and in Canada. Instead, we have agricultural policies, which lead to kinds of perverse outcomes like the subsidization of foods which aren't necessarily healthy. Who do you hold responsible for this state of affairs, and what should change?
Well, I think part of the problem is that we don't think in the big scale in terms of how our food policies at a local, at a state, at a national, federal level really impact people around the world. And I think there needs to be a better understanding of how what I would refer to as a sociological, using one's sociological imagination to realize how all of these different policies interconnect in such a way that the aggregate is actually quite dangerous. And so it's precisely because we don't have a larger understanding of what is global food security that we're creating a scenario where we have a food system that creates global food insecurity rather than global food security.
So talking of this idea of the global food system now, not just in North America, obviously these days the whole thing is connected. So is it fair to say that there's a direct link between the policies that we have in our country, say subsidization of particular industries, and the insecurity that is faced by people in the poorest parts of the world? Is there a link between our subsidies and their poverty?
Well, there's a term that economists like to use called comparative advantage, and that's often used that points to how in every country is ideally suited to produce something, and you just need to find out what it is you're ideally suited to produce. But when you have farm policies and subsidy programs that basically allow some countries to be able to make themselves into a situation where they have a comparative advantage to produce whatever they want because they have the power and the money to invest in certain forms of agriculture, it makes it difficult for other countries to find what their comparative advantage is, because they, if there's been examples where developing economies are able to find the ability to produce something and capture niche markets, but inevitably what happens is that they're not able to capture those price premiums for very long, because then producers in other parts of the world want part of that action and quickly are able to overtake producers in countries and economies that don't have the money to support their farming base like we might in the United States or North America more generally.
Right, so it's cheap for us but potentially very costly for, say, a farmer in Africa. Let's just go back to your original, the original idea here, which is the real cost of cheap food, and perhaps consider the arguments of some of your critics. The food system is going to have to grow a lot in the near future. We're looking at a population of between 8 and 10 billion by 2050. And surely, given that, it's an imperative to produce as much food as we can, as cheaply as we can. What's your counter-argument?
Well, yeah, I agree. Not only do we have more than 9 billion people that we're going to have to feed, but the indications and trends are that we're going to need to produce twice as much meat from livestock between now and 2050. We're moving toward biofuels, so we're going to have to produce more grain, soybeans, palm oil, etc., to be able to produce biofuels. So the trends that we're going are entirely unsustainable. And so it's not, I would argue, it's not about how much food we need to produce, because I would argue we produce plenty of food right now. We're just using it in a silly manner. We're using it to feed livestock, using it to feed our cars, and we have this overweight obesity epidemic, while at the same time millions of people are still food insecure. So I think it's more of a matter of distribution and a better understanding of how food needs to be distributed and redistributed so that those that are most food insecure have access to food. It's a matter of food access, and I don't think it's a matter of increasing production. And we waste a tremendous amount of food. In the United States alone, estimates indicate that we waste roughly 50% of all of our food gets thrown away someplace along the commodity chain.
A staggering statistic, actually. 50% of our food never actually reaches our stomachs. We just throw it out.
Correct. And those statistics are the same in most developed countries. And the percentage of food waste in the United States, at least the statistic that I'm most familiar with, has been increasing steadily since 1974. And indications are that it's going to continue to increase the amount of percentage of food that we waste.
So there's no reason why we can't actually feed 9 billion people. We're just going to have to get a bit clever about how we shift that food around and how we store it and keep it and don't waste it, by the sounds.
We entirely have the capability of producing or feeding 9 billion or 10 billion people. We just need to use our food that we do produce now better.
You mentioned there a minute ago meat production. Can we indeed feed 9 billion people if they all want to eat like we do, with lots of meat?
Well, if they all want to eat like the average North American or the average person from the U.S. especially that loves their hamburger, the answer is unquestionably no. We can't all eat beef at the level of the typical citizen in the United States, because just simply because of a basic biological fact that beef fed in large confinement feeding operation facilities are terribly inefficient. It takes 8 kilograms of grain to result in 1 kilogram of live weight gain. With those ratios, it's like flushing grain down the toilet. But there are other animals that are more efficient. Hogs have a ratio of about 4.5 to 1. Chickens are in the 2.5 to 1, and fish are 1.7 or something like that to 1. And then if you're able to feed those pigs, those chickens, off food waste, which I've already said we waste a lot of food, that's the ability to have your meat, I guess, and eat it too, in a sense.
Okay, so you've given us a really good description of where the trends are going wrong, of where the food system is going to run into problems in the future. Let's say that you're the Agriculture Minister of Canada and Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister, says, "Dr. Carolyn, I back your judgment, go for broke." What would you be doing to our food system in terms of real practical change now that could start to turn these trends around, so we get a food system which is still efficient and producing a lot of food but is doing it in a way which is environmentally and socially sustainable?
Well, I think the most important thing to understand from a food policy standpoint is that there is no single bullet or magic bullet strategy that can be applicable to every country universally. There is a term that came out of the United Nations that refers to the rainbow evolution versus the green revolution. You need multiple solutions that build redundancies into the system, global level commodity chains and local level commodity chains that are able to build in this sort of robust food system. Sometimes, quite frankly, those long commodity chains produce food pretty sustainably. If as long as we want to be omnivores and eat fruit out of season, for example, it's pretty ecologically inefficient to be raising fruits and vegetables in Canada in a heated greenhouse in the dead of winter, when the life cycle analysis indicate that it's actually more ecologically beneficial to be raising those foods in a climate and then actually shipping those foods here. It's kind of counterintuitive, but you're actually having a smaller CO2 footprint, a smaller energy footprint sometimes when those foods are raised in a climate that's suitable for their production and actually shipped here in large quantities. So I would say make sure that you have a food policy in place that allows for a robust global exchange, but also allows for regional and more local too. The food policy entirely ignores, in many cases, those local food systems, and we need to also have policies in place that support them and not subsidize the large commodity chains and the large farmers.
Dr. Michael Carolyn, it's been great to have you on the show today. All the best with your upcoming book release, and hope to have you back another day.
Thank you. I look forward to that. Thank you for having me.
Hurry up, everyone. Get in the car. It's a long way to Kitimat.
All right.
Shotgun. Coming.
Right. So which one of you tree-hugging vegan hippies can actually drive?
I can ride a bike.
These IDs are good for driving.
Useless bunch of stoners. I'll do the driving then.
Thanks, Uncle Alan.
Woohoo! We've rounded up an award-winning team of crack-tearing former journalists, and we're taking them 3,000 kilometers across Western Canada. Following the route of one of Canada's most controversial environmental projects in decades, the multi-billion dollar Northern Gateway Pipeline.
We're speaking to people all along the way. We're talking oil, wilderness, jobs, politics, and money. Join us to find out why people are calling this project the environmental controversy of a lifetime.
And we want you to join us on our radio adventure.
Yeah! Woo-hoo! We'll be broadcasting in-depth reports from Northern British Columbia in August and September. So tune in this time each week on your local community radio station.
Alex, GPS says go left.
Stop poking me.
On the road again with Terra Informa.
Woohoo indeed. Those crazy Terra Informatins will do anything for a good environmental news story. Thank you, Alberta Public Interest Research Group, for your generous financial support of this trip. If our first story of the day made you hungry for more knowledge about the relationship between the food we eat and the environment, perhaps the next story on subsistence caribou hunters in the Northwest Territories will help to satiate your appetite. In our next piece, we speak to two men who live in the Northwest Territories and get much of the food that they and their families eat from hunting on the lands surrounding their homes. Steve Anderson asked these hunters for their perspective on the current state of Canada's barren land caribou herds. This piece first aired in March.
This week I spoke to James Marlowe and Jonas Sangris, both of whom hunt caribou in the Northwest Territories. James lives in Litsike on the eastern arm of Great Slave Lake. That's about 150 kilometers due east of Yellowknife on the opposite shore of the lake. Jonas is from Detta, which is much less isolated. It's only about 20 minutes from Yellowknife. Both men rely on caribou for a large part of their diet, and also provide meat to members of their extended families. I asked them how many caribou they require in a typical year.
When I had my family, my parents were alive, and I usually take about 10 to 15 a year. Now, for my family, I only take maybe 5 a year, maybe not even that.
I usually get 5 to 6 per trip, maybe 15 to 20 per year. And that feeds my family and my mother's household. My mother is an elder, and I tend to provide her with meat. Most people grew up with caribou. We were raised on it, and it's our main staple of food. In the past, we used to, have caribou meat all the time. Now, because of the caribou being so far and only a few people get them, so it kind of difficult on the elders, especially elders who cannot hunt anymore, and also the single people, young families. You know, it's difficult for them to obtain caribou meat.
James says that for Lutzake, problems began with the construction of enormous diamond mines within the caribou's migration corridor.
Well, we noticed the changes starting back maybe 10 to 13 years ago when the big diamond rush started happening here in our backyard. BHP, Diavik, and Snap Lake, and now Gachoku. Those are the four diamond mines. Well, three in production and fourth on the way. And those diamond mines are right in our traditional area. And for an example, Diavik is situated right in the main migration path. They have maybe a couple thousand kilometers of ice route. And 1 year when Diavik and Snap Lake were being constructed, 12,000 truckloads went up there. That's 12,000 trucks. And when you have that many trucks on an ice road at one time, you know, it's just like creating a fence where the ice road is. Caribou used to go around there before, but now they go elsewhere. They go further east from our community. It's been many years since we saw caribou on a lake. They're more scattered away from Lutzake. Nowadays, we have to go hunt caribou to around Artillery Lake, Williams Lake area, which is about maybe 200 to 300 kilometers from our community. And we have to travel many hours and sometimes days to get our food.
I asked Jonas what he thought was causing the declines in caribou populations.
I asked the elder why those caribou are declining. He said it's a cycle thing. He said a few years, there's no caribou, then they'll come back. Same thing with the rabbit, he said.
It goes up and down, the caribou herd. And that's what the elders say in the community. Sometimes, not too much, but, you know, there's a little bit of decline, but it always comes back. But the decline this time is hardly coming back.
Scientists are concerned that there may be more at play than just natural cycling of caribou numbers. Whether that's the case or not, the government's concerned, and in response, they've enacted hunting bans. And that's been hard on people who rely on the caribou.
The hunting ban really affects us. From Lutzake, anyways, on the north shore of the east arm, that's where the boundary is on the ban. I know that if there's caribou there, people are going to go there and hunt just, you know, to feed their families and exercising their treating Aboriginal rights. We've been here for thousands of years, relied on caribou for our survival. Although there's a ban, I know people are going to go hunting. Even myself, I will.
Well, that's exactly what Jonas did last spring.
Yeah, they confiscated all my caribou meat. Saturday, I went hunting early in the morning, brought back 6 to my cabin, cleaned it and everything. About 12:31, come back and I was unloading it and cooking some. Next thing I know, Game Morton came. He and I said, well, sorry, Jonas, we have to confiscate all your meat.
For people who live off the land, caribou are a critical resource. Policymakers find themselves in a difficult position, concerned that they need to act quickly to ensure caribou numbers recover, and yet having to be very mindful of the consequences of their decisions for the territory's hunters and their families. For Terra Informa, I'm Steve Anderson.
Four of our reporters are currently on the road in northern BC, documenting different perspectives on the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. As we've mentioned before, the insights they unearth out west will form a series of special editions we'll bring to you later in the summer. But we thought it would be good to find out how things are going on the road. Yesterday, they gave me a call and left a message, which we'll play for you now.
Thanks, Ian. It's David, Steve, Miles and Marcus here, calling in from downtown Smithers in British Columbia, and we are standing in the car park. We're just underneath the mountain range which runs along the side of this town. It's quite spectacular, and that's where we've been this morning, checking out some of the local biodiversity and meeting some of the locals and talking to them about environmental issues in their town. But anyhow, we're on the road and we're on our way to Kitimat, and we've done lots of interviews so far. So Miles, what's been the highlight for you so far?
That's definitely a tough one. I think just meeting all the people on the street has been pretty good. The response from people on the street to our project's been just phenomenal, and everyone has a very diverse opinion, and we've heard a lot of point of views so far, so that's been the highlight for me.
Because one thing we were thinking at one stage is whether people would actually know much about this project, but as we're finding, most people we run into have got something to say about it. Marcus, what's been the highlight for you so far?
How smoothly everything's gone. We've had a couple of hiccups along the way, but in spite of us having fewer than optimal driver's licenses and money and time, everything seems to be coming together really smoothly. So I think it's going to be a fantastic series, and I can't wait to hear how it's going to come all together at the very end.
Great. And it's a bit of a junction moment for us because we're losing Steve Anderson, who has to get back on the bus to Edmonton, but we're going to soldier on with just the three of us. Steve, we're going to miss you.
Yeah, it's been fun. I wish I could stay for the whole thing, but I'm looking forward to getting back and starting to edit some of the audio and see exactly what all we've got.
All right, Ian. Thanks very much for calling in, and I hope that gives you a bit of an update. We'll just be getting more interviews and catching up with more people in this part of the world for the next few days, and we'll see you next week. Everyone, looking forward to bringing you the local perspective on the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline. See you later.
Bye.
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 Terra Informa airs every week, but if you would like more frequent environmental updates, subscribe to our Twitter feed or find us on Facebook. Thanks for tuning in to Terra Informa. I'm Ian McKenzie, and I've been your host this week. Tune in again next week for the latest environmental news.
CRTC has just recently made a decision to revoke the FM broadcast license of our sister station, CKLN. As Toronto's oldest campus community station, CKLN has been broadcasting since 1983. If you are listening to this station, then you probably understand the importance of community access radio. Please help support our sister station. Find out how you can keep CKLN on the air by visiting their website, www.ckln.fm.
Of the human spirit. Tune in to the Guelph Spoken Word Radio Show Saturdays at 9 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM. GPS, where are you at?
Action Read Community Literacy Center is looking for new volunteer tutors. 4 out of 10 people aged 16 to 65 struggle with reading, writing, math, and other essential skills. Many adults here in Guelph are looking for support in reading job postings, calculating budgets, applying for benefits, and participating in community life. Action Read tutors are trained to help adults work from their current skills to reach their goals in work, learning, and life. If you can spare a couple of hours a week for the next year, you can make a big difference working one-on-one with an adult learner. Action Read has a terrific suite of tools and resources and a wealth of experience to help new tutors develop their skills teaching math, reading, writing, and computer basics. For more information or to volunteer, call 519-836-2759. That's 519-836-2759 or visit us online at actionread.com.